This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret, a Triad stage in Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. The Census Bureau reports that about 17% of North Carolinians live in poverty. But advocates say that even more people are earning less than a living wage. When I say living wage, I'm talking about a household income that you would need to cover daily expenses as well as other needs like child care, health care, and other things that don't really get computed into those factors or factored into those calculations. An interactive video exhibit at Duke University Center for Documentary Studies features the stories of some of the workers who are fighting for higher wages. Among them is Meredith Sawyer. She's an early childhood educator here in Greensboro, and she joins me on the State of Things. Welcome, Meredith. Good to have you here. Tell me, you actually work two jobs, right?
I do.
Tell me about those jobs. What do you do?
I teach full-time Monday through Friday at the Early Childhood Center. It's about a mile down the road in downtown Greensboro. And then I also wait tables usually 2 to 3 times a week.
Early childhood, that sounds like an important job. There's a lot of responsibility in that.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
That does not pay you enough to make
no.
a living. You can't survive on that.
I probably could, but no. I wouldn't want to.
Well, so how many hours on average do you work?
Yeah. Teaching, I work 40-plus hours a week, 40 hours a week on the clock, plus what I do off the clock, which I hope my boss isn't listening to that right now.
Well,
it's totally not allowed.
Can you give us an idea? Would you mind if I asked you what you make?
Would I make an hour?
Yeah, well, so how much you bring in a year, I guess, to talk about that. Some idea?
You know, I haven't even thought about that. Yeah. Probably a little above 20,000.
So you work in two jobs, and so, but what about your expenses? Things that we might not have thought about. We know you've got rent, you know, that sort of thing, and obviously food. What are some other expenses that you have to meet every month?
I have a car payment. That's pretty high price, so.
And you've got two jobs, so you more or less need the car to get to the two jobs, I would
think. Yeah, and right now, with my second job, that's how I pay my car payment. So I rely on that second job just for that.
What about when workers fight for higher? I mean, do you go in and talk about asking for a raise? Can you do that? Are you in a position to ask for more money?
I work for a center that's – I'm actually pretty privileged where I work. Probably one of the highest paid centers in Greensboro, which is sad because it's still not enough. We get a very large stipend for health insurance. So right now I pay maybe $9 or $10 a paycheck for health insurance, and it's a pretty good pretty good health insurance that I have. So I consider myself pretty lucky working there, but I guess I could ask for a raise. I've never really thought to.
Some workers, I mean, I don't know if you're in a position to know about this, but for workers who are actually struggling for and making public demands for a living wage, they report reprisals and that it just doesn't pay in the workforce, that they're really suffering because of it. Have you encountered any of that?
Yeah, I've done a lot of advocacy work for my field just as far as the wages that we get. So I know people that have talked to, you know, politicians and policymakers and all that stuff in the state. They've gone up to D.C. I've been on a lot of different committees that have done stuff like that. So, you know, it's talked about.
I mean, do you have a sense of it? Do you have a sense that you're being pressured in either of your two workplaces?
No.
Is there? What about this conversation, too? I mean, I'm guessing if you went to either of those places, your employer would say, well, either we can't afford to pay you more, which is some version of we could find somebody for the same amount or less.
Yes.
Have you had that happen?
No. Just about every year that I've worked there. No, every year that I've worked there, I've gotten a raise. It could be a quarter raise, but it's still a raise. Right. So I'll take it for what it's worth.
Well, let's find out more about this because, as I said, Meredith's story is one of the many that is featured in an exhibit curated by the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. The display is called Trying to Get By. We actually have two panels from that exhibit right here at the Upstage Cabaret in Greensboro, and there are a couple of more that travel with this exhibit. The collection is video vignettes that tell stories of workers who are fighting for a living wage. It also explores some of the options for changing the policy discussion around this. Joining us now is Ashlyn Knuckles. She's a sophomore at Duke University and helped curate the exhibit. Hello, Ashlyn. Good to have you here.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And Tazra Mitchell is with us as well, a policy analyst with the North Carolina Justice Center. Welcome back, Tazra.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. Let me start with you, Tazra. Let's start with Meredith's story. How common is that?
It is very common. If you, unfortunately, if you look at the type of jobs that we've been creating since our economy started recovering in mid-2009, about half of them pay below what a family needs to make ends meet. And so when we talk about is raising the wage good for the United States, good for North Carolina, what we know is that working your hardest, working 40 hours a week, and not earning enough to make ends meet, that's what's bad for families, and that's what's bad for our economy. Unfortunately, it's happening to many families across the state. We know that it takes about $46,000 to $50,000 a year for a family to make ends meet, depending on their family size, and that's about double of the federal poverty level. We're seeing, you know, just this unprecedented growth in the number of families that are working harder than ever but struggling to make ends meet. And we have to take a hard look at the policy options that are on the table to make it easier for families to get by.
What effect? I mean, we can imagine pretty easily the effect that it's having on those families and those individuals.
Right.
Does it have a broader effect?
Right. So at the family level, it means that they don't have to rob Peter to pay Paul, or rob Peter to pay Paul, that they don't have to worry about, if I pay my rent, am I going to have enough money for my utilities, or am I going to be able to send my kid off to school with a healthy lunch, right? On the broader economy, what we know, and there have been countless studies by economists across the country that show when we raise the wages of workers, there are little to no negative effects on employment. But there is a broader economic stimulus, because when people can afford to pay all of the pieces that go into the family budget, they have leftover money that they can go in and create jobs by being a customer in stores. So when we have to encourage employers to stop seeing workers as a cost-cutting measure rather than an investment, when we invest in our workers, they can make ends meet and they can go out and stimulate the economy by supporting local businesses.
Ashlyn, tell us about your experience in putting this exhibit together and what you've learned.
Yeah, so I first got involved with this exhibit about a year ago now, when I took a class with Professor Bruce Ornstein called Video for Social Change. And so in that class, we were creating the videos that eventually made up really the heart of this exhibit. And we had, you know, the experience of going and talking to North Carolina citizens across like a broad spectrum of professions who are just really struggling to get by. And so sort of the philosophy behind the exhibit, and that's really motivated me to stay a part of the exhibit, is that, you know, these discussions of, you know, what is a living wage, where are we going as a nation and a state in terms of our economy, are things that I'm hearing all the time at a place like Duke, debates, you know, pros and cons of raising the minimum wage, that kind of thing. But a voice that is almost always missing from those discussions is these people who are being directly affected by those policies, which is the workers themselves. And so the philosophy behind the exhibit is to try and bring that voice into the conversation and really help people to understand that when we talk about this, we're not just talking about numbers and graphs, we're talking about people's lives.
So clearly you had some intellectual understanding of this going in, or you couldn't have even taken the project on. How did you change, or did you, as a result of collecting these narratives?
I mean, I think, so I did learn a lot about sort of the state of income inequality, and also just sort of the rapid growth of income inequality in the country, all across the country right now. But also, I think sort of the biggest lesson that I learned is I had always been aware of this issue, but I'd always kind of approached it as like me as a student or somebody who's going to graduate from Duke needs to help out these workers who are struggling. But what I've really learned is that the workers themselves are the people who are really organizing, who are trying to improve their own lives. And it's like my role is to support them, to amplify their voices, but I don't have to spearhead it myself, because they really have a lot of agency and concern in this.
Well, let's hear another one of those voices now. We've been talked earlier with Meredith Sawyer, who's featured in the exhibit. I want to hear another voice now. This is a Greensboro worker whose name is Crystal. Let's listen.
I get off of work about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I walk 2 hours to get home. But before I get home, I have to stop at, you know, my grandmother's house or somewhere to pick the kids up. By the time we get home, it's time for them to get up and go to school.
I was staying with a co-worker's family in Smith Homes, and it's 3 bedrooms. There was around 17 people in and out of the house.
I can't live off of $7.25 an hour. I have 2 children to take care of. I have myself to take care of. You know, they're cutting hours to save money so that they don't have to pay insurance. They'll get us to clock out for break and then make you work off the clock. We're barely getting paid to work, and they're using us for anything that they want to use us for, because most of the time we need this job, and they know that. I don't know if it'd be easier to be one of the people standing on the street holding the sign.
That's Crystal from an exhibit called Trying to Get By, a collection of video vignettes at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. One of the curators is with me here today, Ashlyn Nichols, along with Tazra Mitchell, who's an analyst at the North Carolina Justice Center, and Meredith Sawyer, who's also featured in the exhibit. Ashlyn, 2 hours to get to work. Why is that? Why do we know why that it takes her 2 hours to walk to work? There are no buses available, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's one of the major issues that a lot of these people face is because they don't have money, despite working a full-time, oftentimes more hours than a full-time job. They don't have money for transportation, and if there isn't, you know, a cheap or free busing system, they're going to have to walk to work.
Public transportation shuts down. In her case, she works at Wendy's. Wendy stays open late at 2 o'clock in the morning when
right,
it closes,
yeah.
And they keep her there. That's it. And, of course, obviously a cab ride, would be that day's
right.
pay. But let me ask you a couple of questions that come up in that, Tazra. That one is, she said, because their insurance rates went up, they're cutting back our hours. There does seem to be some correlation, and why wouldn't there be, to paying higher wages and cutting back hours or cutting back on workers? Why wouldn't that be the simple math that any business would do?
So it does sound right. This is what we learn in Econ 101 in supply and demand. But whenever you actually look at what happens on the ground, not just what in theory happens, but what actually happens, we're seeing that when you raise the wages of employees, there's little to no negative effect overall on broad employment. And this is the point that we have to that I want to lift up. And it goes back to just educating employers and the broader public about what happens when you raise those wages. And I think that you have to think about the different steps, right? When you raise the wages of a mother who works more than one job, who has childcare to pay for, whenever she has enough money in her pocket to pay for all of the daily expenses and maybe have a little bit on the side, so when a car does break down, she can afford for those, for those car repairs, which are now taxed under state law. But having a little bit of extra money to set aside so that you can weather economic storms is really important. And then again, I go back to this point that this venture capitalist Nick Hanauer makes about we have to think about investing in our employees as an asset rather than as a cost. And what we see is whenever you raise the wages of a worker, you see less turnover, you see higher productivity, and productivity has not been an issue. Workers are working harder than ever, but the wages are not growing. There's a wedge between productivity and wage growth. So we have to take an honest look at the data.
So there's some data out there, and it proves that this would be a good investment, but it's not yet on the business plan. Again, if I'm
right.
a business and I hear that your wage is not enough for me to get by, I'm saying, you know, the business plan I tanked to the bank mm-hmm. didn't ask me whether or not my workers can get by. They want to know if I can pay my bills.
Mm-hmm.
So the way business finance works in this country, that argument, I'm not making enough to get by, doesn't show up on the loan application for that business to get started.
So I think that that's a legitimate concern, and there might be certain circumstances where they could get some technical assistance to look at their numbers. But I do want to lift up something called a living wage certification program. Local governments have very few tools to raise the wages of workers in their city. They've had some tools taken away. But there are local employers teaming up together and saying, I want to raise the wages of my own employees. And they're coming together, creating these living wage certification programs, and they're placing stickers on their windows. Just Economics does it. In Asheville, there's a whole coalition building in Durham to do this. And they're actively, proactively paying their workers, like Coco Cinnamon in Durham, a living wage because they know that it will keep folks employed, there's less turnover, morale is higher, and they, their productivity is up.
Well, and it's a public action campaign, and what it does is bring into focus one of the things we've left out, which is us as consumers. If we keep buying the products of companies that are abusing employees,
right.
stealing their wages, because wage theft was the other thing
right.
that Cindy pointed out in that, Crystal pointed out in that, she said, they make us work off the clock. This is very common. Corporations and businesses in America commonly steal wages from workers.
Yes.
So that's part of it. And then if we buy the product, we're complicit. And part of the way the campaign works is the living wage campaign. Then you put a badge in your window and you say, I pay a living wage. And now it's up to me as a consumer to choose that vendor over that one that doesn't. And so I think this is part of the picture that also needs to be amplified. We're complicit in this. Right. Meredith, let me talk to you about organizing, because it seems to me, you know, when Ashlyn talks about hearing the voices of people who could really organize, the problem, I guess, for organizing workers is they don't have time. What's been your experience in getting people together?
Yeah, the few times that I have met with different committees, it's not a lot of people in my field. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. One is we have lives. You know, we have to leave work and go home and deal with our families or work a second job and all this stuff. And we don't have time to do that. Where the meetings are, a lot of people don't have transportation to get to them. In our field, we have to have a certain number of training hours. So for those meetings, we're not offered training hours. So a lot of people don't see much of an incentive to come either.
Tell me more. I'm going to get back to wage theft. So here's kind of part of the problem. Tezra, let me ask you about, in terms of public policy initiative and bringing attention, what's the strategy? What's your strategy?
So we have to have the Secretary of Labor in the state go after businesses. The News and Observer had a very long series that Mandy Locke did that looked at wage theft in the state. And the Secretary of Labor has tools that she can use to, especially when it comes around contract work, enforcing the laws on the book is one step, but going a little bit tougher on businesses that have a track record of stealing wages from their employees.
Is enough being done in this state?
Absolutely not. And that's what Mandy Locke's series was all about. Yeah.
So, and that's the interesting thing. The underwriters at the bank, when you come with the loan and the business plan, they're pretty rigid in their enforcement of those rules of finance. And yet if we're lax in our enforcement about protecting workers' rights, then you have an asymmetry that needs to be addressed and could be. We've got the tools, as you suggest.
Absolutely. And I think that we just need a leader in that office who is willing to do the work that's required to protect workers. There's no reason for you to work a full week and not get paid for it. It goes exactly against what our country stands for.
You can link, by the way, to the series that Mandy Locke did in the NNO about the Labor Department and its failure to enforce the rules that protect workers at our website, stateofthings.org. And I want to thank all of you for being on our program today. Tazra Mitchell is a policy analyst with the North Carolina Justice Center. Ashlyn Knuckles, a sophomore at Duke University, and helped curate the exhibit Trying to Get By. And Meredith Sawyer, an early childhood educator here in Greensboro. Thank all of you for being on the program. Wonderful to have you. By the way, the exhibit does travel. It's going to be in Charlotte next month and Rocky Mount in May, and you can find out the details about that at our website, stateofthings.org, as well. Just ahead, the life and times of improvisational musician Eugene Chadbourne. Here he is right now. He'll play us through the break, and we'll come back and hear much, much more.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. And the young boss, he's a real dog. I'd say he's a fool. He's got himself a brand new flat top haircut. Lord, he thinks that's cool. One of these days I'm gonna blow my top. He's gonna pay. Don't you try to get in my way. When I get up the nerve to say, take this job and shove it.